It's The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD from Slate, in for Tanzina Vega. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. The number of cases and deaths worldwide from the novel coronavirus is continuing to rise, with more than 165,000 people reported dead. Health resources around the globe are being redirected toward the fight against COVID-19. That's true in both wealthy developed nations and in developing countries. But it has some global and public health experts worried.
Because of the attention that countries are giving to the COVID-19, I'm worried that other health programs are going to start to fall and not be given the priority they've been given over the past decade.
That's Dr. Michael Merson, professor of global health at Duke University and visiting professor of global health at NYU, and former director of the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS.
I'm greatly concerned that we're going to see a fall in immunization rates. I'm worried we're going to see a fall in the global response to AIDS and TB and malaria, to maternal and child health and maternal mortality. It's expected, but still very worrisome, that the pandemic not only will cause great suffering and death from the disease itself, but also will allow other health problems to become exacerbated and cause a great deal of mortality and morbidity.
Lois Pace, president of the Global Health Council, agrees, especially when it comes to countries with weaker health systems.
Their health systems already are having a hard time addressing a spectrum of issues, and to add on to that is only going to create more problems.
For Lois, Michael, and many others in the public and global health fields, these concerns only deepened when President Trump last week announced his intention to freeze U.S. funding for the World Health Organization, pending an investigation into its handling of the coronavirus outbreak. President Trump has been highly critical of the WHO's handling of the pandemic. I spoke with Michael and Lois about global health issues that COVID might be exacerbating and about how funding of the WHO fits into the picture. And I asked Lois what diseases or programs she was particularly concerned about getting short shrift in the coming period.
We are already hearing about shortages or stoppages in country. We're hearing about, for example, in the supply chain, there being issues around receiving medicines for HIV, antiretroviral therapies, also TB meds. They're using the same supply chain that now we need for COVID-19. And in a lot of countries, especially that have limited resources and infrastructure, it's really hard to manage all of the above, if you will. So having to shift their limited resources to now address the pandemic absolutely is causing a problem. And that's going to create a lot of issues and a ripple effect across various needs in these communities.
And whose shoulders does that fall on? Does that fall on the WHO, individual countries, nonprofits? Sort of who feels that?
I think the people on the ground. That's who's on the front lines of all of this. You have healthcare providers in country. Many times they are armies of one or just a handful of people. You have community health workers, right? So people who are essentially lay individuals, but very well versed in public health needs and community health needs. And yet they are being faced with making decisions as to whether they can follow patients living with TB or now being pulled off to address some of those same needs or similar symptoms among a COVID-19 population or a population at risk for COVID-19.
You know, we're in this moment where, at least certainly in New York where I am, a lot of other healthcare concerns are on pause. And as a pregnant woman, I'm one of the rare people who has been into the hospital, and you see sort of no one in many parts of the hospital. And then, of course, the ER and the ICU have lots of patients in them. And I guess I wonder, on a global scale, spinning out from that, which things have you most concerned? Is it vaccination? Sure. Is it, you know, delaying regular care? What worries you the most?
Well, I'm glad you brought up women, and congratulations on your own pregnancy. I hope that that's moving along
it's fine.
As smoothly as can be expected right now. But We actually saw in the 2014 outbreak in Ebola some fallout when it came to maternal health services specifically. And so that's an example of something that worries me, is that women don't have access to that very important care throughout their pregnancy and at a very precarious time. And we know from data that in some of these settings, in some of these communities, women don't survive pregnancy, unfortunately, and babies don't survive always without that critical care along the spectrum and along that timeline. And so we are very concerned, a lot of us in the community, about that as an example, particularly because we saw how that played out again in West Africa during the Ebola outbreak.
Mike, you led the WHO's Global Program on AIDS, and I wonder what were some of the challenges that you faced internationally when trying to coordinate help and care, and what the parallels are now.
It's a different time and a different pandemic, but I think we saw some of, in the case of AIDS, we saw some denial that this wouldn't be a problem for us. So we certainly saw that with COVID in the United States. We saw a discrimination quite a bit in the early days of HIV, and we're starting to see that certainly against Chinese people around the world. But we're also seeing, even in the United States today, we're starting to see some discrimination against African Americans and Latinos who seem to have higher rates of disease in a number of our urban centers. A third issue, of course, is that AIDS was first recognized in the United States and in European countries primarily, but in the end, its greatest impact, and we still see this today, were in the low and middle income countries. Today, of course, we still see a severe problem in parts of Africa. I think we're going to find the same pattern with COVID-19. Of course, most of our attention to date has been on the middle-income countries of Asia, on Europe, and of the United States. But there was a recent study done from Imperial College, which shows that projection, of course, but a projection that we're going to have some 1.4 million deaths, even under the best of circumstances, in our low and middle-income countries. Mm. So the great concern that I have is where are we going to be a year from now, or even 6 months from now, in terms of the impact of the pandemic in the poorer countries. Now, we don't know, this is just a projection, but it is very worrisome. And I think also to point out that the countries that would normally, the richer countries would normally be providing support to the lower income countries for their health programs.
Right.
Well, I fear there's going to be a drop in that support because the economic situation in Europe and in the U.S. and North America in general, there's going to be a shortfall, I think, for development aid.
Lois, what does that mean for, say, a country or a group of countries where they might be experiencing both COVID-19 and also things like tuberculosis, malaria? Right. How do you deliver care for sort of multiple health crises at once?
I think coming back to Mike's point about the resources required, I mean, this is why we at the Global Health Council have been really trying to argue for a greater investment on behalf of wealthier countries in lower resource countries that really do require that support in bolstering their health systems. And we're hopeful that in these funding packages that Congress is considering over time, and we're expecting them to consider yet another package for COVID-19, that they're not just focused on the domestic response, but they really are keeping in mind that unless we can beat this pandemic everywhere, we're not really going to beat it anywhere. And so at least in the short term, we are making that case. And in the medium and long term, coming back to the importance of investing in those systems so that they can withstand any shock, not just respond to the current crisis, but even beyond today for the next outbreak, because we know from experience that this can and likely will happen again, unfortunately.
Can I add to that? I think that's a really important point, that in our globalized world, if we have large pockets of COVID-19 in countries that are frequently visited in Africa, Asia, Latin America, by U.S. citizens, we can be sure that that is a sure ticket for having the virus come back to the U.S. and we'll have our second and third waves. I work in Singapore, and Singapore had only had about 100 cases, and now they're up to 4,000 in a period of 3 weeks. And a lot of that was because Singapore citizens who had been living in the U.S. and the U.K. brought the virus back to Singapore. And we're going to see the same thing here. So I hope our political leaders understand that it's really important that we deal with this pandemic on a global basis. Of course, this then gets to the role of WHO.
Right.
It is the one agency, whatever fault it might have, this is not a time for blame. And it is the one UN agency that exists in the UN system to provide countries information on prevention and treatment, diagnostic tests, supplies. It helps countries figure out their best strategies for containment and mitigation. It's going to be critical for getting drugs and vaccines out to particularly lower income countries, and supporting critical research. So we need to remember the globalized world we live in, and that this is truly a global pandemic. And we can't just narrowly focus on our own situation and think that that'll be sufficient.
Well, Lois, how big a deal is it if the WHO actually loses U.S. funding?
Oh, it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal because the U.S. government does contribute quite a bit to WHO. And I think that those of us in Washington are still trying to figure out the impact of President Trump's decision in dollars and cents. But we're very concerned, given the WHO is so reliant on these types of contributions, and they are critical in helping guide not just low-income countries, right, but all countries in their response in this moment. And they have even partnered with our own government agencies like the CDC in how to respond in the U.S. If the WHO didn't exist, we wouldn't have a replacement for it. And again, we're not in the moment where we have the opportunity or the flexibility to recreate that anytime soon.
Mike, when you look at past crises and sort of what the WHO has been able to handle when they're dealing with an outbreak, say Ebola or something else, and then working on their sort of regular track programs, are there examples of things going well where we can say, actually, here's a good playbook?
Well, certainly going back to the 1980s, where eradication of smallpox was a great WHO feat. It's been a major player in the eradication of polio, which we're almost at. But I fear now we may be set back by not able to do the last bit of work we need to do to eradicate the wild polio virus. WHO has certainly provided many types of assistance to countries in this area of pandemic response since the Ebola outbreak. There was criticism of WHO's performance in West Africa. It was late in getting there. But with the new director general's appointment in a few years ago, there was the feeling that the organization now with a real African leader would take on the strengthening its pandemic response, and also very critically, the strengthening of health systems, which has been a real priority for WHO. And I think has really motivated many countries to take universal health coverage as a really important goal, with whatever shortcomings it has. And sure, maybe it could have handled itself a little bit better earlier in the epidemic. Although I think if one goes back and looks carefully, the director general almost daily was warning everyone about this pandemic and was able to get a diagnostic test made within a few weeks of the virus being genetically characterized. And I think for the most part, one would have to say that WHO's response in this case to COVID was much better than it was in previous epidemics. And I would add that it's absolutely wrong to blame WHO and responsible for what unfolded in Europe and in the United States. We acted late, as did European countries, and we need to look into the reasons for that. But on our list of reasons is not WHO.
Lois, you have been working in global health for a while, and I sort of wonder if this moment is one in which people say, oh, now I understand what it is that you do and why it's important.
Yeah, no, I have that hits closely to home for me because even my own mother has called to say, wow, now I know what you do and how important it's been. And she even sometimes asks how Dr. Tedros is doing. He looks very tired. He seems like he's under a lot of pressure. And I try to assure her, yes, and he's still quite capable. But yeah, no, it's really changed, I think, the way at least I experience the work in global health and the purpose I have right now. And I say that I think a lot of others in this field feel the same. I mean, we got into this because we believe so much in the fundamental nature and value of health and well-being. This is the WHO's mission, but this is a mission, I think, shared by the lot of us in this field. We know that health drives everything, really. And how much is that playing out today? I mean, the entire global economy is at a standstill because of a public health crisis. And so I think we are, many of us, disheartened by the state of affairs currently, but also somehow encouraged that we do have the solutions, let alone the passion, to show up every day, whether we're talking about frontline health workers who were doing their best to fight back this pandemic, or people like me and Mike, who are behind the scenes, but certainly trying to do our own part to ensure we all have the answers and solutions to this grave problem and get to the other side. I mean, I truly believe we will get to the other side because we do know what to do. It's often a matter in global health and public health of just getting out of the way, allowing the experts to do their job, believing the experts, abiding by those recommendations, and then getting the job done. You know, but if we can put resources behind this, if we can put energy behind this, yep, then we truly will be successful. I believe that.
Lois Pace is president of the Global Health Council, and Dr. Michael Merson is a professor of global health at Duke University and former director of WHO's Global Program on AIDS. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Lizzie. Appreciate you having us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.